uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome, greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from California, coast to coast, from California and Oregon to Pennsylvania and West Virginia, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system all across the United States, now in Canada as well, and streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, live365.com is American FM, and on cable systems in 29 states on CRN Digital. So welcome back to our program. Tom Hartman with you. By the way, just as a heads up, George W. Bush is going to be giving a speech tonight about the Iraq situation, as they say. And so we have somebody in the White House recorded him rehearsing it while he was doing his aerobics. And we have a little clip, which we will be playing for you a little later on in the program. But first, Dr. Yaron Brook is with us. He's with the Ayn Rand Institute. Yaron, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
It's always great having you and Andrew Bernstein on. I think that it's important that people hear your point of view for a variety of reasons, one being that Ayn Rand had such an impact, her book Atlas Shrugged and the whole objectivist movement, which then kind of led to the libertarian movement, which informed many of the conservatives, certainly the Grover Norquist variety of conservatives economically in particular, in their philosophy, and that you guys are sort of you're really the philosophical fathers, in many cases, of the modern conservative movement.
Oh, and, I don't want to take credit for those guys.
Well, but it's true, don't you think?
Not really. I think they use Ayn Rand and they use her ideas when it's convenient for them, but they distort them and they misrepresent them. And of course, they base much of what they do on religion, and Ayn Rand was an atheist, as you know.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And there are some areas where you guys go in separate directions, you know, but I think particularly in the economics and what should be government, you know, what role should government play, there's a lot in common. And so I just think it's important that we have these conversations, that people get the underpinning of your point of view and my point of view, for that matter, you know, we can share it. And so as the grist for that particular mill, should tax-supported broadcasting be eliminated? You're suggesting the conservatives in Congress here a couple of weeks ago, or last week, tried to pull basically, you know, put the noose around Big Bird, pull a bunch of funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which some folks are suggesting soon will be renamed the Corporation for Republican Broadcasting, if Ken Tomlinson has his way. And you're suggesting, hey, just do away with the whole thing. Take them off the air. We don't need them anyway. Is that it? Not that I would put words in your mouth.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying taking them off the air. I'm saying eliminate government funding. I'm saying that it's not the role of government to fund broadcasting. If there is a market for Big Bird, then it shouldn't be hard to raise money for Big Bird, whether it's through charitable contributions that, you know, they do those fund drives on a regular basis, or whether it's by selling sponsorship advertising. But it's not I who don't like Big Bird, who actually think that Big Bird does, you know, the kind of the way they try to teach writing and so on Big Bird and on Sesame Street is actually can do harm to kids. I don't want to support Big Bird, so why should I, through my taxes, do that? Somebody else who thinks Big Bird is great, let them support it.
Now, we have a long history in the United States of supporting media with our tax dollars, even media we don't like. We in the very founding of this country, we were supporting, subsidizing, actually, the manufacture of paper for newsprint. And from that day to this, we support a lower postal rate for newspapers. And these, of course, are commercial ventures, but still, this is our tax dollars being used to support media.
Well, I think that's true, and that's a huge mistake. I think that the more government gets into the business of media, as you said, I mean, NPR or whatever, or PBS will one day become a Republican station. That's horrific, you know, just as much as I think they are today very much liberal stations. I think that when you get government involvement in any type of media, you get government influence in that media, and that is harmful to the prospect of free speech. But more important than that, people should not be forced to fund things that they don't like or disagree with, and therefore it is leave it to the market. If there really is a market for NPR, and I believe there is, I think they do a good job, then people would fund them. They'd find mechanisms by which to raise the money. Big Bird is a very popular show. I have no doubt that Big Bird is not at stake here. They use Big Bird. I mean, PBS brings out Big Bird because it's so popular. But, you know, nobody, if PBS was suddenly made private, Big Bird would not go away because it has too much of a market, and we know the value of having that kind of market.
But the situation today is that only 118 people, enough to fit in a moderate-sized class, university classroom, make up the membership of the boards of directors of the 10 big media giants who constitute roughly 90 to 93% of all the media that Americans are exposed to. 118 people. These 118 individuals, in turn, sit on the corporate boards of 288 other national and transnational corporations. And in fact, 8 out of the 10 big media giants share common memberships on their boards of directors with each other. You prefer our media be owned by 118 people? You say that's a free market?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and the fact is that we get such diverse media. I mean, you get Fox News that many claim is a spokesman for the Republican Party, and we get CNN, who others claim is a spokesman for the left. And, of course, we're not even counting the thousands of media outlets. I mean, I get most of my news, and I think a lot of your listeners probably get most of their news today on the Internet. And on the Internet, I can scan the New York Times, for kind of the left-of-center view to the, I don't know, Philadelphia Inquirer. It tends to be maybe a little bit more right-wing. I don't know. But the point is that you get this enormous variety of media today. There's no shortage in point of view, as I think your radio show is one indication of that. Not only, you know, is it a liberal radio show, but you interview people from the Ayn Rand Institute. So people exposed to such a variety of point of views. I'm really not concerned about the concentration of media in the hands of a few people. Anybody curious at all about what's going on in the world can log on to the BBC if they want and get what get the European point of view on this.
But we're talking with Yaron Brook here of Ayn Rand Institute, aynrand.org, their website, by the way. We're really talking, when we talk about access to the website or to the internet at this moment, about the middle class and the upper middle class in the United States. I mean, there's a lot of people who simply don't have that luxury, don't have that access. And if we look at the corporate-owned media, the media that is run by those 118 people on the boards of those corporations, in the run-up to this war in Iraq, we got a steady diet, basically, of lies and jingoism. Do you disagree?
Well, I mean, partially. You know, as you know, I'm not a big supporter of the one Iraq at all, but I think that people had options. I don't think it was driven by – I don't think the fact that they got this one line was driven by the 118 board members. I think it was driven by the fact that most people in the media bought into the story. Both people on the left and on the right bought into this notion the war was justified. Might have been a mistake, but I put it this way. I think it's a much greater evil to violate people's property rights by forcing them to support things they don't like, or by breaking up media, or by not allowing mergers, than it is to have concentrated media. I mean, the fact.
But
is
when
that
GE fired Phil Donahue,
yep.
They did. You know, the memo that came down said, you know, we can't have. You know, there's a war is coming. It's time to be flag waving. We got to compete with Fox.
Sure.
We can't have an anti-war voice on the air. And Phil Donahue was the most profitable show on MSNBC.
Well, I think that's GE's right. GE has a right to voice its opinions and to deny people.
So then,
from its,
you know, I don't disagree with you. I don't disagree with you on that. But the larger question is: shouldn't we have the equivalent of a BBC? Shouldn't there be something that is not controlled by left or right? That's not controlled by corporate America or the bureaucrats in Washington, D.C., that has independence and has its own commitment to the truth. And frankly, I don't think that our Corporation for Public Broadcasting is even there right now. But shouldn't we have that?
But you know that that can't happen. As soon as government starts funding an organization, of course it's going to have a point of view, and of course it's going to reflect a particular point of view. The idea that PBS or NPR are somehow independent is ridiculous. I mean, I would argue that NPR is incredibly liberal. I mean, it's way out there.
Does liberal mean?
Well, it means that it tends to be anti-free market. It tends to be anti-anything proposed by the Republicans, whether it's good or bad. It tends to border on, the economic stuff that's presented on NPR tends to border on socialist nonsense. But it's systematic. I mean,
NPR does not have opinion shows, Yaron. We're talking about Yaron Brook of the Iran Institute. I mean, they just present the news.
But you know very well that you can present the news in a slanted way. I mean, you can present the news in a way that, you know, just by the words that you use that denounces businessmen, or you can present the news in a way that is friendly towards businessmen. You can do the same thing towards particular politicians. I mean, these things that they're very clever about it, just like the New York Times is very clever about it, about slanting their views in very subtle ways, but they do it. And the point is that, you know, this is a station which I, by the way, again, I listen to every single morning. And if it wasn't funded by the government, I would actually give a contribution to, but I won't because it's got funded by the government. I'm already contributing through my taxes. I think it's wrong for taxpayers to have to subsidize something that they disagree with or agree with. If they want to support it, they can pay. I think it's a violation of my right to free speech. It's a violation of my property rights to have to do that. And of course it's going to be biased once it's funded by the taxpayers, because who's going to run it? A bunch of bureaucrats, and those bureaucrats are going to be influenced by their bosses, the politicians. That would be like saying the guys who run the regulatory agencies are always going to run it the same way, no matter if it's Republicans or Democrats running Congress or the White House. And you know that's not true. Of course they're going to do it.
No, now we have all our regulatory agencies being stacked with people from industry so that they're not regulating anymore.
Well,
much to the detriment of we the people.
I mean, I would like to see all those regulatory agencies done away with and gone. But that's my point. The point is that you cannot have institutions funded by the government who stay independent, neutral.
When they created this back in the 60s, they created a two-year buffer. Any decisions made by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting can't be instituted for 2 years at the level of NPR or CPB or at NPR and National Public Radio and National Public TV.
That's why it'll take you know 4 more years until the Republicans get their hands on NPR. NPR is still controlled by the Democrats. The point is that these are political instruments.
But no, these buffers are in there to prevent the politics.
Yeah, but they don't work, and they cannot work, because the fact is that the money is being provided by politicians. Any institution where the money is provided by the politicians is going to become
political. But a lot of the money right now for NPR is being provided by corporations. I remember when NPR outed Archer's Daniel Midland. Now they're taking money from them. They don't talk about this corporation's crimes anymore.
Well, but that, you know, get the government out of there. Let whoever wants to fund these.
But
shows
then, when private industry comes in, then they're going to say, okay, here's the money. You know, don't talk about us and people. They're going to do it.
But then there's the Tom Hartman show that does talk about them. I mean, that's the beauty of the American system. If I want a radio show, I go out there. If I can get an audience, I can raise the money and have a show.
Yeah, well, it's...
And you have one, which is proof that it's possible.
There you go. Okay, Dr. Yaron Brook, Executive Director of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org, their website. Yaron, thanks so much for being with us today.
Good talking to you.
Good talking to you, too. I appreciate it. 20 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Drop into our website, TomHartman.com, if you want to get into our live chat room and join the conversation. Should we continue public broadcasting or not? Interesting. 20 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where smart people get their news. Talk radio for the rest of us. Our toll-free number, 1-866-889-8894. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our chat room. Shannon in Minnesota on the line. Hey, Shannon, what's up?
Oh, I really wish I could have talked to, what's his name?
Yaron Brook. Yeah, well,
I suspect
I can tell you what his position would be if you'd like to, you know,
yeah.
I can kind of debate by proxy if you want.
I just wanted to ask him what NPR he's listening to, because I listen to NPR 5-6 hours a day, and they are probably the most, to use the term, fair and balanced I have ever heard of any news organization. I think a lot of people think that, you know, because they're watching Fox or because they're watching MSNBC and they're seeing all this, and frankly, it is right-wing spin.
Yeah,
because they're seeing all this, they don't know what fair and balanced is anymore.
Well, it's absolutely true, and BBC is now under attack in the United Kingdom again by the same forces. And it really, what it goes back to is Harry Truman's old dictum. You know, they called him give him hell, Harry, and he once one time he was talking to reporters, and he said, "I never gave anybody hell. All I did was tell them the truth, and they thought it was hell." And that's the situation, is that you've got a bunch of people in Washington, D.C., both on the corporate side, which is the folks that, you know, Yaron isn't like funded like competitive enterprise institute folks, you know, the shills who are out there saying that there is no global warming kind of thing. I mean, he's not funded by big corporations, but philosophically, Yaron's perspective is that if a corporation does it, it's got to be good because eventually the free market will clean everything up, right? It's an absolute belief in the free market. And I suspect that he would, you know, that I'm not mischaracterizing him. They're not taking into consideration the fact that there is an agenda to corporate America, to corporate media as well, and that, you know, if we had, you know, part of the solution obviously would, you know, be enforcing the Sherman Act and breaking up big media corporations. But even then, I think that we, the people, collectively can get together and say, you know, we would like to have a source of just good, solid, straightforward news. But there are forces out there that don't want the truth being told, period.
I think you give the guy a little too much credit. I think he knows that the corporations have an agenda, and I think it's his agenda, too, and that's why, well, I'm not...
No, with Yaron is a, you know, the folks at the Ayn Rand Institute are true believers. Yaron really believes that ultimately, see, his, what he would tell you is that we haven't really tried capitalism yet.
Yeah.
That if the government got out altogether, completely got out of the way, then you had a complete corporate takeover of all the media, and you ended up with just one guy, you know, Rupert Murdoch, owning everything. Even in the worst case scenario, that eventually that would break down because there would be demand for other products and the free market would fix itself.
And sunshine and rainbows and everything.
That's right, exactly. Well, in my opinion, I mean, you know, they believe that that's the solution to everything, and I'm of the opinion that that won't work. You know, these are the arguments that reasonable people have. Shannon, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. It's good to hear from you. Thank you so much. 1-866-889-8894. Jeff in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, I'm sort of thinking about this. I wanted to run it by you. I think we've been losing the culture war based on the fact that we're not coming up with good sound bites to match the sound bites coming out of the other side. Seems like we're throwing the bullets and they're shooting them back at us.
Well, let me first of all suggest to you, Jeff, that we're not losing the culture wars, that we're winning the culture wars. The other side is going down in flames.
Well, I hope
the
that
vast majority, you look at any survey, more than 80% of Americans want national health care. The majority of Americans want us out of Iraq. The majority of Americans want cleaner water. The majority of Americans don't support Bush's attempts to harm and hurt our public school systems. I mean, just pick an issue. Excuse me, go ahead.
I would like to pick an issue, the Ten Commandments in the courthouses. I'd like to reframe this. Tell me what you think about this. Every liberal should have a bumper sticker on their car saying, liberal for the Ten Commandments, even if you're atheist, even if you're Muslim or Buddhist. Here's why. Let's talk
wrap
about
it up quickly here.
The Sabbath. No more Super
so,
Bowl
so
Sunday.
So we should stone people. We should put people to death who work on the Sabbath?
Well, yeah, but no more Super Bowl Sunday. Close the Disney theme parks on Sunday.
Yeah, exactly. If we were to actually go out there and start pushing that agenda, maybe they'd wake up. Maybe they'd say, hey, wait a minute, we shouldn't be doing this. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Good point. It's 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So long, honey, baby, where I'm bound, I can't tell. Goodbye is too good a word, baby, so I just say fairly well.
And welcome back, my friends.
I ain't saying you treated me unkind. You could have done better, but I don't mind. You just kind of wasted my precious time. But don't think twice, it's all right.
Yes, Bob Dylan. I just have to listen to a little more Bob Dylan. It's just so good. Welcome back. 26 and a half minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our toll-free number. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our chat room. Joe in Provo, Utah on the line. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. You know,
you look at 10,000 years of history, it says whenever you get powered people together and money, it's always at the disadvantage of us.
Oh,
I mean, I just
yeah,
want
the average person.
I don't have any idea where this guy grew up or how he could possibly think that way. He can't be connected to the fact that most people, not just in this country, but our influence around the world by supporting corporations through, you know, 1953 with the overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh and the democracy
in Iran.
That went on there in Iran. Yeah. And then El Ende in Chile and Guatemala, Barents and Guatemala, Ecuador, $2 billion in arms for El Salvador to dictators to put down the people's desire to have self-determination. And then, of course, Vietnam and Ho Chi Minh's desire to have a relationship with us, only the Prussian. I have no idea where
this. But I can tell you, you know, I won't even try to speak for Yaron on this, but here's what the Grover Norquist of the world would say, and that is that that those are all the sins of government, that in fact if corporations had been allowed to simply rule everything, they'd really only be interested in making money, and therefore you wouldn't have wars. You have to understand, Joe, in my opinion, and I don't mean this as a slam on these folks, this is more a religion, this is a belief system than it is they call it a philosophy or, you know, whatever, but it's a utopian philosophy. It's a, you know, this will solve all problems. And their argument, the argument that libertarians make, for example, is that if corporations are running the show, they're not interested in having wars because wars are not profitable. Now, my argument is that it's the other way around, that in fact, many, many of our wars, you look at United Fruit controlling, you know, the big fruit companies controlling Nicaragua. I mean, that's why we were down there, right? It's long ago. I mean, back in the late 19th century.
Well, we spotted 600,000 people in the Philippines in order to make room for Dole to come through or something like that.
Well, that's interesting because that was a war that was under McKinley in 1898. And, 1898, and McKinley's guy was the role model for the whole. There are some who suggest, some historians, who was simply to be reelected, was simply to gain political capital. And Mark Hanna was his handler, and Karl Rove has said that Mark Hanna is his role model.
Yeah, and the philosophy, if I'm not mistaken, and you can correct me, is, you know, the white guys have got to take care of things because we're destined by the Bible of God that we know to go forward. So you get this ideology has continued through, and there has been this constant desire to reach into the principles that, I mean, Jefferson and all these other guys, to me, everybody goes, oh, look what they did, and they did. But they did it under the tensions. I mean, they were going to go to war against England. They needed somebody to fight it. So they wrote up this really wonderful PR piece called the Declaration of Independence that promised people something they didn't have so they'd go fight.
I'm not that cynical. I'm sorry. Joe, I'm sorry. I'm not that cynical. If you look at what happened, every single person who signed the Declaration of Independence had to leave their home, as you know, and 17 of them came back to find nothing left. Many of them lost their wives, their children. You know, I mean, they all sentenced themselves to death when they signed that.
They did. Let me rephrase it. I don't mean to be cynical because you're right. What I'm saying, though, is had it just been up to them to have to fight, they knew that they had to basically reach out to the nation, to the people that were there, to give everybody a reason to be invested in this effort.
Yet most of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence actually fought in that war, Joe. You can't say that of the people who are this Iraq war. You know, you're not seeing George Bush send his daughters over there. You're not seeing Jeb Bush send Jeb Bush Jr. over there. You're not seeing Karl Rove send his son over there. They're just not showing up. They're just not showing up at all.
But I wasn't trying to be cynical. What I was trying to say is that, I mean, the Rhode Island Regiment was all black, if I understand correctly, and Lafayette looked upon them as one of the finest regiments.
Yes.
You know, and then they were reconsigned back to slavery.
Reconsigned back to slavery. No, they weren't. Slavery was illegal in Rhode Island, and it remained illegal in Rhode Island after the war.
Oh, okay, great. So, anyway, the point is all of the people that were more or less disenfranchised from the economic stream and so forth, they stepped forward. You know, it was a combination of energies that really brought this nation into the fore. You know, I guess is what I was trying to, I didn't mean to sound
cynical. No, I get your point, Joe. And in fact, you know, I thank you for calling. You made your point well. Here's my position on this. I just lay this out and just say, I am a believer in controlled capitalism, as it were. I just don't think that you can have pure capitalism, because if you do, you're going to go back to a feudal state. If we were to do what the Ayn Rand folks are suggesting, what libertarians are suggesting, and just get government out of the way altogether and let the corporations run everything, we would end up in a feudal state. You would end up with rule by the rich rather than rule by the warlords or rule by the theocrats. We would be back to one of those three forms of tyranny that the founders talked about so often. On the other hand, if government comes in and says, okay, we're going to run all the businesses, we're going to run the shoe factories, we're going to run the car factories, we're going to run everything, then you have, you know, rule by bureaucrats, that, and that doesn't work either. I visited the Soviet Union when it was the Soviet Union. I'd been in East Germany when it was East Germany. Didn't work. And so what is left? Well, what is left is something halfway in between the two. And that's what we've been doing from the founding of this country up until, well, we are still to this day. And that is, we say, okay, we recognize that free enterprise and capitalism do accord some benefits to society when they operate properly, that they, you know, the growth comes out of that, the businesses can grow, that the, you know, jobs and employment and the economy grow. You know, there are benefits to it. We also recognize that it has the potential to become a cancer. It's like in a biological system. Every cell is programmed to reproduce itself. There's a benefit to that. But if a cell reproduces itself too rapidly, too much, too often, if it runs cancer, and there is a cancer stage to capitalism. And so what restrains that? Well, in a biological system, what restrains that is homeostasis. There are normal regulatory checks and balances, and they all have to do with a system of laws, basically, that are set up in a biological system that are imprinted in the DNA of the organism, that cause the liver to keep the stomach from taking over, and the stomach to keep the spleen from taking over, and the kidneys to, you know, and it's really even more at the molecular level, at the cellular level than at the organ level, but you get my point. And so the legal system, as it were, the laws, the superstructure is imprinted in the DNA. And I'm suggesting that that is the purpose of government, is for we the people to collectively say, okay, great, we love it when people make do business and make money, as long as it's not harming society. Just like in an organism, you know, we love it as, you know, if the leaves are growing on the tree, but if one particular leaf decides that it's going to get 30 times larger than the rest of the leaves, we've got a problem, the tree would say. And so, you know, it's a matter of saying, okay, it's fine for you to do this. However, here are the rules to the game. And with regard to public broadcasting, frankly, I'm of the opinion that we must collectively have access to some source that has no filter for the news. Now, I realize how difficult that is. I mean, I've worked in news for 7 years. I was a news reporter back in Michigan back in the 70s. And I know how hard that is. You got to do a newscast. Which stories am I going to report? I mean, just that decision in and of itself introduces a certain level of bias. But it is possible, I believe, and I believe that much of our news reporting in this country up until the Reagan era and up until the deregulation in the mid-80s, 86, 87, in particular, up until the end of the Fairness Doctrine, much of our news reporting in this country actually was relatively free of bias. And when it did have bias, like Woodrow Wilson tried to hustle us into World War I, he ended up with a black eye for it, and so did the media. And was appropriately vilified for it. So anyhow, I think that we have to have some source of news where we can say, you know, that's simply what is. And we're not going to get that if we rely on corporations, because corporations have a primary agenda, which is not serving the public. The primary agenda of a corporation is to make money. And I'm not arguing that that's a bad thing. It's just something that we have to acknowledge. And if the primary agenda of the organization or institution which is bringing us the news is to make money, and their secondary purpose is to deliver to us the news, then eventually what we're going to discover is that instead of the news, we're hearing about shark attacks and Michael Jackson. Because that makes more money than telling us what's going on in Rwanda or telling us what's going on with the voting machines in Texas or in California. When ultimately finding out the facts, the details, being an informed electorate, that's really what's necessary for democracy. And that's why, A, I support public broadcasting, even though I realize that at some level I compete with them, and B, why I don't think that our public broadcasting system is working right. Because the day that they started taking corporate sponsorships, so a decade or more ago, was the day that it began being corrupted. And began being corrupted by corporate interests, by what is broadly referred to as the right. And now you got Ken Tomlinson in there, you know, trying to rename it as the Corporation for Republican Broadcasting. And you've got the former co-chairperson of the Republican National Committee as CEO. And I think it's frankly a bad thing for democracy. Thomas Jefferson was right. You can't have democracy without an informed electorate. You can't have an informed electorate without news. And in my opinion, you can't rely just on the free market and corporations to provide the news. Similarly, I wouldn't want government as a propaganda function to be providing me with the news. I don't want to hear the news from Pravda and TASS or TASS. I would like to hear the news from something like the BBC. And that's why most of the advanced nations around the world, most of the fully developed, fully industrialized nations around the world have developed their own in-house version of the BBC. Because it's good for democracy. That's why I believe it should be there and it should be funded. And that's why I believe that in order for NPR and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and Public Television, in order for them to work, they have to, number one, do away with all corporate sponsorships. All corporate sponsorships. And be fully funded by we the people, like the BBC is. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Alan in Hinton, Oklahoma on the line. Hey, Alan, what's up?
I purchased me an art program from Small Dog Electronics. It's a real good company, and I just thought I'd mention that.
Good on you. And they sponsor this program, Small Dog Electronics, yeah.
Also, I'd like to ask when you can find Ayn Rand organization about the abuse of powers of the East India Tea Company. What do they say about that?
Well, you know, I've never had that conversation with them, and it's a good one. I'll bring it up next time we get them on. My guess is that what they would say is that eventually things would balance out, and that the problem was that the East India Company and the king were in bed with each other, and there you have government in the middle of it. Because by and large, the doctrine of the libertarians and the objectivists is that, you know, basically beyond the protective function of government, that is to make sure that, you have an army to defend the country and you have police departments, that government has no purpose. And, as I said, I disagree with that. I believe that we the people can get together and say, hey, collectively, we the people want to know that, for example, Yaron said that he thought all regulatory agencies should be banned. I strongly disagree. I think we the people can and should get together and say, we want to make sure that our air is clean. We want to make sure that our water is clean and pure. We want to know that our food is safe. We want to know that our drugs are safe. We want to, this is not, in my opinion, this is not rocket science. And I don't think that the free market will ever solve that problem. We tried that. You had snake oil salesmen, literally snake oil salesmen. They would come in the covered wagon in the 17th and 1700s and 1800s and show up in a community and say, here you got this. Here's Lydia Pinkham's tonic. And you buy this and it'll cure all your problems. And it turns out it was opium and cocaine with a little bit of licorice added to it. And maybe some oil from, rattlesnake venom or something, some snake oil. And they were, selling this stuff, and people were getting addicted, people were dying, and it wasn't working. I don't think that the market solves all problems. I really don't. I think sometimes we the people collectively have to get together to solve problems. Alan, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Mike in Washington, D.C. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Tom. A quick little anecdote for you from back in the 50s. Speaking about TOS, you triggered that for me. I remember there was and this is a true event, by the way. There was a track meet, I believe, between the U.S. and the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the only two competitors.
Right.
And the Americans won. And the way that it was presented in the headline of the sports page in TOS was, Americans come in next to last.
There you go. Yeah.
It's a true statement.
I believe you, Mike. I believe you. I'm familiar. I've actually, Pravda did a story about me last year. You know, I've got it hanging up. It's in Cyrillic. But yeah, the old saying, there is no Pravda in Tass, and there is no Tass in Pravda, you know.
Exactly.
And that's why we don't want government, ultimately government itself in its pure government function. And this is the problem with Ken Tomlinson. You know, he's, you know, him and the person that they've just picked to be the head of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is that they're involved in these phony video news releases. And we don't want government supplying us with propaganda. That's why the Corporation for Public Broadcasting was set up as a separate entity, separate from government, but funded by government. And there's a big difference. And you know, I think it was an appropriate thing. I think it's a healthy thing. I think it's a good thing. And I think, unfortunately, it's been terribly corrupted by corporate influences up to this point. And, you know, should be changed, should be fixed. And the way Tomlinson's talking about it is not going to do it. And the way Yaron wants to do it doesn't do it. Got a note from Carla here, too. I'll share that with you after the break. Plus, a bit of George Bush's exercise video this morning as he was practicing his speech for tonight. All that right after this break. It's 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
What's wrong with this picture?
Well, let's see. It's got George Bush in it and the war in Iraq and the 9/11. Somehow, I guarantee you tonight, George Bush is going to figure out a way to tie Iraq to 9/11. Even though Iraq has nothing to do with 9/11, 9/11 was perpetrated apparently by a Saudi by the name of Osama bin Laden who was in Afghanistan. And 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi citizens. None of them were Iraqis. Osama bin Laden had nothing to do with Iraq. In fact, he hated Saddam Hussein, who ran a secular regime. But I guarantee you tonight, Bush will figure out a way to mix the two up in his speech. Guaranteed. Here's this morning in the White House. Somebody, Bush is in his exercise room working out. He's walking on his treadmill, listening to techno music, and he's practicing his speech, reading it off the teleprompter. Here he is. Well, maybe he's not. Apparently he's not. Oh, here we go. We'll try it.
I will use this moment of opportunity to bring depression and war. We should also destroy the economy. And I support regimes that sponsor terror. I will lead our nation toward a culture that values violence. The American people need to be stopped. It's time to bust this economy. Let's get it done. Once and for all.
Yes, indeed.
I'm against working people dying.
This is Bush. Bush does exercise.
My budget nearly doubles funding for weapons of mass destruction. We are arming to threaten the peace of the world. I ask you to pull all the murderous ideologies of the 20th century. The civilized world is rallying against us. I will not relent in waging this struggle for fascism, Nazism, and totalitarianism. And the dictator who is assembling the world's most dangerous weapons is ruling America.
There you go, George Bush practicing on his exercise machine, preparing for his big speech tonight, in which I guarantee you, I absolutely double-dog guarantee you, tonight he's going to mix up 9/11 and Iraq, even though there's no association between the two, and he's going to try out his tired old line of, we're fighting those Iraqis on the streets so that you won't have to fight them in New York or in your hometown. Like, they're going to get on a plane and come over here. Come on, if we got out of there, if we got out of the way and said, here's your country back, they want a job. They would go back to work. It's what happens in every country where you have an insurgency. Once the invaders get the French in Algeria, the French in Vietnam, us in Vietnam, once you get out, the country gets back to work. They go back to work. There's no more terrorism. There's no more war. It's the same when the British left North America. What did we do? We went back to work, even though they called us terrorists. Well, you just watch tonight. It should be very entertaining.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to our program broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, Live 365's American FM, WhiteRoseSociety.org, where our program is also podcast, and on cable systems in 29 states on CRN Digital. It's the Tom Hartman program. That's me, Tom Hartman. Glad to be with you. Bioneers. It's our Bioneers segment, our weekly Bioneers segment. Bioneers are scientists and artists, gardeners and economists, activists and public servants, architects and ecologists, farmers and journalists, priests and shamans, policymakers and citizens. They are everyday people committed to preserving and supporting the future of life on Earth. Paul Stamets was president of Fungi Perfecti, a mail-order business supplying cultures, equipment, and mycotechnologies to mushroom cultivators throughout the world. Fungi, or how do you say that, Paul? Fungi?
You can say fungi or fungi. That's
Or fungi. I've heard both, and I never knew. So both are right. Okay, great. Your website, fungi.com. You've discovered four new species of mushrooms, pioneered countless techniques in the world of the field of edible and medicinal mushrooms cultivation, and in fungal bioremediation. Also the author of five books, including Growing Gourmet and Medicinal Mushrooms, The Mushroom Cultivator, and Psilocybin Mushrooms of the World. Welcome to the program, Paul.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Paul, what role do you play, what role do you think that fungi will play in the new industries of the 21st century?
Great question, and very timely. Today, my book goes to the printer. It's taken me about 7 years to write. It's called Mycelium Running, How Mushrooms Can Help Save the World. And mushrooms are a great healing. They are produced from a fine fabric of cells called mycelium. And these mycelial cells are this cottony cobweb-like material that you see when you pick a mushroom. Virtually, we all see it when we're in the garden. If you kick over a log or a plant, you see this fuzzy material. Well, these mycelial mats achieve the largest sizes of any organism on the planet. The largest one found thus far is over 2,400 acres in size, 2,200 years old.
That's the one that's in the roots of the aspen grove up in the northwest, isn't it?
Actually, it is in a fir forest in eastern Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another one that's 1,200 acres, and Michigan first came out because they had a 37-acre one, a junior individual, comparatively. But these mats, actually, they generate soil, and they hold soil together, and they are the premier recyclers on the planet. They're the bridge between life and death. And our soil depth is directly related to the activities of these fungi, without which we would not have the life support system that we enjoy today. The species diversity of fungi is something that is an ongoing target because it keeps on expanding. We right now, current estimates are there's 1 to 2 million species of fungi. About 10% are mushroom-forming fungi, around 150,000. But we've only identified 14,000 species of mushrooms to date, which means our ignorance exceeds our knowledge by at least one order of magnitude, and actually we think by several orders of magnitude.
Yeah, okay. I'm curious. I took some cordyceps this morning, which is a fungi that grows on the cocoon of something, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
It's sold as a Chinese medicinal. My Chinese medical guy says, take this stuff. Are there medicinal mushrooms? I mean, is cordyceps really a medicinal mushroom? And what other medicinal mushrooms are there out there? And on the other hand, are there mushrooms that a lot of people are eating mushrooms, and there's a lot of different kinds of mushrooms to eat. Are there mushrooms that people should avoid or that people should be looking for because they have particular medicinal value?
Well, good questions, and I'm not sure if we have enough time to answer all of them. Cordyceps is a big genus, and there is one called Cordyceps sinensis, which is what you are probably taking, and that's very, very helpful. There's lots of research that is being published. We are the sole source suppliers for the first two NIH-approved clinical studies in the United States. One using oyster mushrooms to help HIV patients, and the other one is a $2.3 million breast cancer study using turkey tail mushrooms to help fight breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
These are the second study is involving several hundred ladies at stage three and stage four breast cancer. There's lots of other mushrooms out there, and one that I would like to mention, which I think it would be fascinating to your listeners, is one that is known by the Greeks. It was called agaricon. The Latin name is called Fomitopsis officinalis. This mushroom is now thought to be extinct in Europe. It was first mentioned over 2,000 years ago by Dioscorides as a treatment against inflammation. We still have this mushroom in Washington State, in Oregon, and in British Columbia. About 2.5 years ago, I got involved with the U.S. Defense Department's BioShield program, and I've submitted over 200 samples of mushroom extracts. And we started getting the research results back about 1.5 years ago. And actually, I couldn't talk about this until about 3 months ago when the U.S. Defense Department finally gave approval. But in short, more than 200,000 samples were tested by the U.S. government, and two of my samples of extracts coming from this super rare mushroom that's exclusive to the old-growth forest is highly active against pox viruses.
Hmm.
It is more active against than any other pharmaceutical that was tried. In fact, it was the first natural product to show strong anti-pox activity. We've been approved by the CDC for animal studies, and I think we now can make the argument that we should save the old-growth forest as a matter of national defense.
As a way of preventing the danger of the Black Death, of the plague?
The public may not be well aware of this, but the greatest threat from terrorists is bioterrorism.
Yeah.
And the greatest bioterrorist weapon that is available, unfortunately, to them is smallpox. If a nuclear explosion went off in Boston, as terrible as that would be, it would not shut down airplane travel between Seattle and San Francisco. However, a pox outbreak would.
Yeah.
It would cause trillions of dollars worth of damage. And so looking at the cost-benefit ratio, if indeed when we go through animal studies and we find that this rare mushroom it prevents pox infection or can treat it subsequent to the fact, then obviously it exceeds the value of the timber in the old-growth forest. And I think, you know, true conservatives should be advocates for environmentalism, because true conservative individuals want to conserve resources, money, and the heritage for our children. And for us to lose this biodiversity by cutting down our forests puts us in great jeopardy, because we may be losing the very antidotes to the diseases that we face in the future.
Right. Remarkable. We're talking to Paul Stamets. Am I pronouncing your last name right?
Yeah, that's fine.
Paul Stamets. He runs www.fungi.com, president of Fungi Perfecti. And Paul, Brian in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, is on the line with a question for you.
Hey, I was just wondering, how come they could sell spores for psilocybin mushrooms, but you actually can't buy psilocybin mushrooms?
Well, because Schedule 1, Title 21 of the Federal Drug Code specifically mentions manufacturing and also mentions that any substance containing psilocybin or psilocin is illegal. But spores don't contain psilocybin or psilocin, and so as a result, they are not illegal. However, upon germination, they begin to manufacture it. So it becomes a fuzzy part of the law, and I'm fairly familiar with the subject. And, you know, I think the argument could be made upon germination that you are manufacturing. So it's something that the customer should be aware of.
But those ads where they say that in High Times magazine and whatnot that are offering psilocybin mushroom spores are actually offering psilocybin mushroom spores?
Yeah.
Whoa. Okay, that's a whole other discussion. Okay, so what mushrooms are in our food chain? We've got, lacking all the names. You know, I'm not a mushroom gourmet, but I know that there's at least a half a dozen different kinds of mushrooms that occasionally you'll come across in restaurants, from the little tiny, little very thin, delicate ones that you find in Japanese restaurants very commonly, to the great big, you know, look like wood fungus ones that you'll find, you know, grilled portobellos, for example. Do these have medicinal value? And then also your standard white mushrooms that I guess are grown in cow manure or whatever, you know, that are sort of factory farmed. I mean, is there a downside to factory farmed mushrooms? Are they as bad for us as factory farmed food in general that's grown on deficient soil?
Well, I'm a strong advocate that all mushroom growers should be certified organic, as we have been for over 20 years. Mushrooms are a reflection of the environment in which they are grown. And so I think it's very important that the public realize that buying locally from certified organic growers is the best route. There's a lot in the process that's hidden from public view, unfortunately. Mushrooms, I no longer know the difference between gourmet and medicinal. All gourmet mushrooms are medicinal. The best available gourmet / medicinal mushrooms out there are shiitake, maitake, enoki, oyster mushrooms. Portobellos and white button mushrooms are sort of complicated, but if they're cooked at high heat, they do afford you some beneficial properties. Button mushrooms have aromatase inhibitors, and this is important because
Button mushrooms being
the white button mushrooms or the portobellos. They're actually the same species. They're just two different varieties.
Okay.
So the browns and whites and the portobellos and the cremonese and the white buttons are all actually...
These being the mushrooms that are typically served in an average restaurant in America.
That's correct.
Okay. You were saying.
And, breast cancer, there's an association with an enzyme called aromatase. And if you can inhibit aromatase, then you can inhibit the growth of breast cancer. As it turns out, button mushrooms, maitake and reishi, and oyster mushrooms all produce aromatase inhibitors. So this is important, especially with postmenopausal women who are at risk that using these mushrooms in their diet can be a cofactor in limiting carcinogenesis. This is why, you know, it's interesting and ideal.
When you cook these mushrooms, does it wipe out their value or does it enhance it?
It enhances it. In fact, all mushrooms should be cooked. You should not eat mushrooms raw. They give you almost no nutritional advantage whatsoever.
Should you boil them, fry them? Does it not matter? Is it just the heat?
Yeah, you have to soften their tissues. So if you achieve boiling point or greater, then it makes the mushrooms highly digestible. So if you're eating mushrooms raw, they literally pass through you unchanged.
You don't absorb the nutrients from them?
Not at all.
Well, that's remarkable. And yet, you know, fire is relatively recent. Well, actually, a couple of million years, I guess, humans and pre-humans have been using fire. So you could say that we've adapted to these.
Well, it's very, very interesting that you bring that up, because the oldest botanical object ever associated with prehistoric humans is a mushroom that's a wood conch. That is called the Iceman fungus, and the Iceman also had this fungus, and it's a fire starter fungus, and it actually allows...
He was carrying it in his pouch.
Carrying his pouch, and allows for the portability of fire.
Remarkable. We've been talking with Paul Stamets. He's the president of www.fungi.com. Check it out, about the mushrooms and the mushroom world. Thanks so much, Paul, for being with us for our Bioneers segment.
Okay, Tom.
Do appreciate it. Keep up the good work. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We will be hearing a little bit more of George Bush's rehearsal for his speech tonight in a few minutes. But first, we have Ellen Ratner with us with the Talk Radio News Service with the daily report from the belly of the beast. Hey, Ellen.
Well, the belly of the beast finished an energy bill today, 85-12 in the Senate. It includes about $18 billion in energy tax break. It expands ethanol use, provides for increasing natural gas imports. However, it will go to conference. And, of course, what does the House have in it? It has drilling in the ANWR.
Yeah.
So that is kind of interesting. Denny Hastert today, who's the Speaker of the House, sort of glossed over any difference between the two versions. And so everybody's saying yay, 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 and we'll see what happens. The the Supreme Court also today said it's going to consider whether anti-abortion protesters may have violated federal racketeering and extortion laws during their campaign against abortion clinics, and that's kind of interesting. It is a case handed up basically from the Seventh Circuit, and it's Operation Rescue versus the National Organization for Women.
So Randall Terry might go to jail?
Well, that would be nice.
it's amazing. That Randall Terry and Neil Horsley, you know, a marriage made in heaven. Neil Horsley, of course, the anti-abortion guy who runs the website where he has pictures of doctors and maps to their homes, and the guy on Alan Colmes' show said that he has when he was a teenager, he had sex with a mule on a regular basis. So, yeah, very
yeah.
These are the people who want to tell women what they can do with their bodies.
Exactly. Also, a federal appeals court today found that the federal trial judge did not abuse his discretion when he held that four reporters were in contempt for failing to reveal their sources. This is that lawsuit brought by Wenho Lee.
This is probably an extension of the Supreme Court decision yesterday about Judith Miller and Matt Cooper.
And clearly they waited for this.
Yeah.
And, of course, as you were talking about, the president is making his speech. And, as you know, Senator John McCain is even more seriously considering his 2008 run. And apparently the Grover Norquist-McCain feud came out today. It was on roll call. Of course, Norquist makes no apologies about calling McCain a nut job. And so apparently, you know, Mark Salter, who has written several books with McCain, came back and said, there's never been a shortage of blowhards and boars in this town. I'm sure Grover is comfortable in their crowded ranks, but that hardly merits the attention he craves.
That's interesting. You know, several of the right-wing sites now are starting to try and they're trying to do preemptive attacks against McCain, just like they're trying to attack Hillary. You know, they're saying McCain's going to do a Ross Perot thing and split the ticket.
Well, I actually think, I mean, I happen to like Senator McCain. I also like Senator Lieberman. They're much more further right than I am. But I think in terms of decent human beings, they're both decent human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, I think if they made a ticket together, they would beat everybody.
A fusion ticket.
A fusion ticket.
A conservative Republican and a conservative Democrat.
Yep.
Interesting. Well, that would
be my prediction.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll see. I'm frankly waiting for, you know, the next FDR to come along. And you're of the opinion.
You've got a long wait.
You're of the opinion that Hillary Clinton is not that.
Yes.
Okay. But who?
Definitely of that opinion.
Yeah. But who might be out there that could be a standard bearer for returning America back to the values of working people in the middle class and strengthening our industrial infrastructure and bringing our troops home and you know, building this country back up?
I don't know. We're going to have to do a lot of looking. Maybe we ought to do a contest with your listeners to see who can really come up with some people who will appeal to the middle.
I think Howard Dean can do it. I really do.
Howard Dean can too, but he says he's not running.
Yeah, which is a shame because I really think that Howard Dean would make a great president. And you know, I watched him 10 years. I lived in Vermont. I watched him as the governor of Vermont. I think he would make a great president. But anyhow, Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you tomorrow. Great, always great to hear from you. There's a daily report from the belly of the beast, Washington D.C. 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, toll-free nationwide, tomhartman.com, our website if you want to drop in and say hi. And, of course, we have this little clip here, George Bush working out in the exercise room in the White House this morning, practicing his speech for tonight, the President of the United States.
As we gather tonight, we constitute an axis of evil. We want to sap the soul and drain the spirit from our citizens. I'm sick and tired of democracy. As I mentioned to you, it's important for our the soul and drain the spirit from our citizens. I'm sick and tired of democracy. As I mentioned to you, it's important for our citizens to understand fear. We've got the American people pretty well under control. See, democracy can't work, and it must be opposed. What I care about is money. I want to empower the wealthiest Americans because it wants peace, freedom, and slavery. Ignorance is strength. Evil is good. Yeah, I would hope that everybody got the message that the brutal and lawless set history's course. Let's roll.
There you go. George W. Bush practicing for his speech tonight. On a more serious note, that, by the way, the bots, the producers of that. On a more serious note, I guarantee you that what George W. Bush is going to do tonight is he's going to try and recycle some of the lies from, you know, that led us into this war. I mean, it's just as predictable as night following. That single exception, and they're not unique in doing that, by the way. Far more money is coming out of Saudi Arabia for those folks than was ever coming out of Saddam Hussein's Iraq. With the exception of that, they had done just that. They had absolutely done just that. They had stopped all, you know, Iraq was building nothing. They had no weapons program. They had nothing. And yet, nonetheless, George W. Bush figuring out a way to basically, you know, stretch the truth. Here's as Bush continues on with his speech, he says,
"The Iraqi regime has violated all of those obligations."
I'm sorry, they provided you with 14,000 pages documenting what they had done. They let the inspectors in. They could go anywhere they wanted.
"It possesses and produces chemical and biological weapons. It is seeking nuclear weapons."
None of this, of course, was true. And now we know from the Downing Street minutes and the Downing Street memos that Bush knew that it wasn't true, that they were ginning up this war simply so that George W. Bush could get what he called, what he referred to as political capital, so that the Republicans could take the Senate back, so George Bush could get himself reelected in 2004, or what he thought of as reelected. It was his first actual election. He was appointed in 2000. So he could get himself elected in 2004. And as he told his biographer, he needed that political capital so that he could push forward his program and not have what he called a failed presidency like his father. He wanted to have a successful presidency. He wanted to dismantle the New Deal, do away with those pesky programs that are those awful socialist programs like unemployment insurance and veterans benefits and Social Security and workplace protections and the Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Let's put industry in charge of all of these things, right? And so, number one, he's going to try and say that Saddam represented a threat. Saddam represented no threat whatsoever. No threat whatsoever. In fact, here's Bush again. This is another one of his little ditties about this stuff. Outrageous. First of all, actually, he starts out talking with this. He starts out talking about the Niger, the uranium lie that was in his speech. And it turns out that he had been informed. In fact, it had been removed from several previous speeches before it got into the State of the Union speech that the British were, you know, looking into the Niger and uranium. And Joe Wilson had said, no, it's not the case. There's nothing there. The British were even saying, come on, this is, you know, this is a forged document. We know it's a phony document. And Bush tried to explain why, even though he knew it was a lie, he put it in. He's going to blame it on the CIA. And then he gets to the Whopper lie. Here's the CIA lie.
Subsequent to the peace speech, the CIA had some doubts. But when I gave the, when they talked about the speech, when they looked at the speech, it was cleared. Otherwise, I wouldn't have put it in the speech. I'm not interested in talking about intelligence unless it's cleared by the CIA. And as Director Tenet said, it was cleared by the CIA.
Now, here's where then he gets into the really big lie. Keep in mind, when the United Nations said to Saddam Hussein, you must disarm, you must allow the weapons inspectors in, they said, okay, fine. here's a list. Here's 14,000 pages, every weapon program that we've ever had and proof that they've been destroyed. And your inspectors can go anywhere, anytime they want. And in fact, Hans Blix and Mohammed al-Baradei came back and said, you know, we can go anywhere we want, anytime we want. We can even look under Saddam's bed. We can even go into his presidential palace and look under his bed. I mean, we can look anywhere. And they were begging Don Rumsfeld, who was saying, oh, we know where those weapons are, saying, please tell us where they are so we can go find them and give you a justification for your war, your invasion. But anyhow, Bush, and then Bush was the one who pulled the inspectors out. He said, you've got it. You've got to stop. Blix is saying, no, just give us 2 more weeks, somewhere between 2 and 6 more weeks, and we will find. We will find, Hans Blix said, give us 2 to 6 more weeks, and we will find out whether or not, for sure, there are any weapons of mass destruction. And Bush said, no, you've got to come out, because we're going to start the bombing. But then Bush says in a news conference, just get this.
The larger point is, and the fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in. And he wouldn't let him in. And therefore, after a reasonable request, we decided to remove him from power along with other nations so as to make sure he was not a threat to the United States.
Right. And Hans Blix said,
you know, in the Middle Ages when people were convinced they were witches and then they looked for them, they certainly found them. And this is a bit risky. I think we were more judicious in saying that we want to have real evidence. And I'm not going to cite what the intelligence agencies are saying unless I have the evidence for it. If I had that, well, then I would do it.
But he never had that because there was no evidence because there were no weapons. Bush lied us into this war, very simply. The second thing he's going to do tonight in his speech, the first thing is he's going to restate that Saddam was a threat. When Saddam was not a threat to us, he was arguably a threat to his own people. Although, if you want to say that the United States is in the business of taking out dictators, we've got a long way to go. We will be absolutely broke before we're done. I mean, if our job is to say that, you know, what we're here all about, our entire job is to take out dictators, we're in big trouble. I mean, we've already spent $179 billion, $179,672,850,000 in Iraq. And we've appropriated almost twice that, almost $300 billion, prepared to spend. But we've already spent about $180 billion. That's enough money to send 23,797,733 children through a year of Head Start, through a year of the Head Start program. That's enough money to fully insure 107,588,575 children for a full year. I'm not sure there are even that many children in the United States. We could have paid for a national health care program with the money that Bush has spent in Iraq. We could have hired an additional 3,113,754 public school teachers for a year with the money that Bush has spent so far in Iraq. And keep in mind, that's only half of what's been appropriated. We could have given full 4-year scholarships at public universities, full 4-year scholarships, all included, to 8,710,151 students with the money that Bush has spent already in Iraq. Just what he has spent so far. You drive down the street, you see homeless people out with their signs, you know. We could have built 1,617,787 additional public housing units with the money we've spent so far in Iraq. 1,600,000 of them. Say, well, you know, there's bigger problems. There's hunger in the world. We could have fully funded global anti-hunger efforts for a full 7 years. For 7 years, not one single hungry person in the world with the $179,673,000,000 that George Bush has spent so far on the invasion and occupation of Iraq. Say, well, you know, there are other problems. What about AIDS? AIDS is a worldwide. We could have fully funded the AIDS programs all around the world for 17 years. With the $179,673,000,000 that George Bush has spent so far in Iraq. We could have immunized every child in the world against all the major diseases of the world which threaten us for 59 years with the $179,673,000,000 that George Bush has spent so far in Iraq. But he had to have his political capital. He had to get himself elected in 2004, and he had to get the Republicans control of the Senate in 2002, and so he lied us into a war. You're also tonight going to hear him mix up 9/11 in Iraq. Even though we were attacked, you know, on 9/11, we were attacked by a Saudi, by a group of Saudis, actually. The majority of the hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. They were, 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis. Not a single one of them was from Iraq. None of them were from Iraq. Osama bin Laden, in fact, hated Saddam Hussein. Tried to invade Saddam Hussein. Tried to invade Iraq after the Afghan war was over. He went back to Saudi Arabia. He gathered together an army of his merry band of Mujahideen guys. And they went to the border with Iraq. And they were going to invade Iraq and take down Saddam Hussein. Why? Because Saddam Hussein was allowing women to drive. Because Saddam Hussein was allowing women to vote. Because Saddam Hussein was running a secular society where the mullahs, the priests, did not run the show. And that was intolerable to Osama bin Laden. Just like it's intolerable to Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and Dobson, James Dobson. That, you know what? A secular society? How dare they? And when bin Laden tried to invade Iraq, his own country, the royal family, the Saudi royal family, his own country stopped him and deported him to Somalia, or to the Sudan, excuse me. So that's it. You're out of here. And at that point, he said, okay, you guys have the power to deport me because the United States is propping up this corrupt regime. I'm going after the U.S. And he came to us and he said, in the mid-90s, he said, if we didn't stop propping up a corrupt regime in Saudi Arabia, and if we didn't take American soldiers off Saudi soil who were put there in 1991 by Bush Sr. to help stage the war in Iraq and Kuwait, where we had horror of horrors, you had men drinking alcohol, and listening to horrible music and watching videos and possessing pornography. And you had women, you know, Playboy magazine, no ban on that. And you had women who were driving and who were not covered on sacred Saudi soil. And he said, if you don't remove them, he's going to attack us. And George Bush, from the time he came into office until 9/11, got no fewer than 56 specific presidential briefings and directives and security intelligence briefings saying Osama bin Laden's coming, they're going to hijack airplanes, they're targeting high-profile buildings, it's going to happen sometime in the early fall, look out. And what did Bush do? He went on the longest vacation in the history of the presidency when he finally, on August 6th, got the presidential daily briefing titled Osama bin Laden Determined to Strike Within the U.S., when he finally got the word, okay, this is it, he's actually coming to get us, he had done nothing to prevent this. The Clinton administration had been working its butt off. They tried to assassinate Osama bin Laden. They missed him by 30 minutes, lobbing cruise missiles into Afghanistan. They stopped several plots to attack the United States. The Bush administration, they put Dick Cheney in charge of the counterterrorism task force. How often did it meet between the time that they came into office in January of 2001 and 9/11? None. Zero. Cheney was too busy with his energy task force, meeting with his friends in the oil industry and saying to we the people, you're not allowed to see the notes of this, sorry. So the other thing I guarantee you is going to happen tonight is the Bush is going to mix up 9/11 with Iraq. In fact, he'll probably do it the way he did it the last time. Saying something like this.
We must also never forget the most vivid events of recent history. On September the 11th, 2001, America felt its vulnerability, even to threats that gather on the other side of the earth.
And therefore, we should attack a country that had nothing to do with it. It's like, gee, we've been attacked by the Japanese at Pearl Harbor. Let's go to war against Brazil. It literally makes that much sense. We were attacked by a Saudi from Saudi Arabia, funded by Saudi Arabia and the Bush and Reagan administrations. And probably the Carter administration, for all I know. We had been funding the Afghan resistance for some time. I know for sure that the Reagan and Bush administrations had funded Osama bin Laden and the Mujahideen against the Soviets. It was part of our plan to bring down the Soviets or to resist them. We were attacked by a Saudi who lived in Afghanistan. So what do? We let him go, and we go to war against Iraq, a country that didn't attack us. Why? Good question. A lot of people asking that question. Nobody's really absolutely sure. I mean, you know, Dick Cheney has his take on it.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. Could be. I mean, that's an important part of the equation. But the most important part of the equation, we now know from the Downing Street minutes, the Downing Street memos, is that Bush thought that by attacking Iraq, he could gain enough political capital that the Republicans could seal control of the House, the Senate, the White House, and the Supreme Court. This was a war for political purposes. And that, my friends, raises it to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors against the United States. This is a crime against the United States. This man is going to go on television tonight to try to justify. You just watch. It's 10 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hello, trouble. Come on in. You talk about heartaches. Where in the world you been?
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 5 minutes before the hour, 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number tonight, George Bush going to do some serious bloviation, 5 p.m. It'll be fascinating to see how he can try to wiggle out of this one. I predict it's going to be, we're fighting them there, so we don't have to fight them here, as if the people of Iraq, who had no problem with terrorism before we showed up, are just, you know, if we leave, they're all going to come to New York, right? They're all going to show up in Lawrence, Kansas. They're all going to be here in Portland, Oregon. I don't think so. Typically, insurgency movements, when the irritant is removed, go away. When we, you know, when we kicked out the British in 1776, we didn't, you know, who called us terrorists. We didn't go looking for somebody else to pick on. Oh, let's go pick on Canada. No, it was like, let's get back to work. I'm telling you, the average Iraqi, the forefront issue, the main thing that the average Iraqi wants is a job. 1-866-889-8894. Jeff in Denver, Colorado on the line. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, as usual, Bush with his framing and his bloviatorial tonight, we can use his framing to, given what Rumsfeld's saying, that, you know, it's going to take a long time, I guess we could call this the mission not accomplished speech.
There you go. I think that Rumsfeld really went around the edge on that thing. I have a feeling that the administration is very, very unhappy with Uncle Donnie.
Yep, and now we could probably call this whole thing Mission Impossible.
There you go.
Well, you were seeing the fragments all over the place. I mean, the Republicans are fragmenting, the administration's fragmenting, the generals are speaking differently than Romney and so forth.
What do you think is going to be the main lie that Bush is going to use tonight to try and justify this war?
It's probably going to be the usual. Otherwise, I mean, I'm really clueless about anything new.
Yeah. I'm guessing it's going to be terrorism. And again, Iraq had nothing to do with terrorism. Beyond the Saddam Hussein was sending $25,000 to the families of suicide bombers in Israel. And he was not alone in doing that, by the way. That's coming out of Saudi Arabia right now as well, our ally. Not officially, not from the government, but from people within Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I see nothing new.
Yeah, I think he's going to use terrorism, and he's going to use 9/11, and he's going to do everything he can to obscure the fact or divert our attention away from the fact that he declared this invasion and is maintaining this incompetent occupation purely to try and gain political power. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. This is the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank.
Been listening to the Tom Hartman Program? Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Wow.
uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Want to be an ambassador? Want to become George Bush's next ambassador? The German news magazine Der Spiegel, sort of the German equivalent of Time or Newsweek. And Der Spiegel, fascinating article published yesterday. They have an English edition on their website as well. It's spiegel.de. Well, an article by George Mascolo. Want to become a U.S. ambassador? It's not as hard as you may think. So this getting back to our theme, as it were, for this hour. Is it a cliche, really, that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer? You know, it pays more than ever to be at the top. The median total compensation for the 100 highest paid executives in the Washington Post's, this is from the Washington Post, Washington Post's annual survey of executive pay was $5.25 million in 2004, up slightly from the year before, 5.13. IBM shifts 14,000 jobs to India. Coincidence? An internal IBM document suggests that the firm will hire 14,000 workers in India this year, a number that's so close to the 13,000 people it will lay off in Europe and the U.S. that sheer coincidence seems unlikely, even to the far from cynical. The New York Times said it was passed the document by the Washington Alliance of Technology Workers, dated April this year, but IBM told the newspaper that the job boost for India was a demonstration of how the economy there was thriving. Well, let's see. IBM, they're going to lay off 13,000 people in Europe and in the United States, and they're going to hire 14,000 people in India, and it's just a coincidence. This is, you know, Ross Perot, the giant sucking sound, remember? This is corporatism. This is international, quote, free trade, so-called free trade. This is what happens when you turn trade policy, a nation's trade policy, over to multinational corporations that have no commitment to the nation, that only have a commitment to making a profit. Alcoa to cut 6,500 jobs. Alcoa said it would take a second quarter charge of 25 to 28 cents a share and eliminate 6,500 jobs as part of a previously disclosed plan to streamline the aluminum producers' operations. Here's another one. More companies terminate pensions. Big employers sharply accelerated freezes and terminations of pension plans last year, steering away from the increasing expense and uncertainty of paying for workers' retirements. But soon you're going to have jobs. There will soon be jobs at nuclear power plants. Forget the fact that 90% of the world's uranium is in the control of 10 nations. And that all of that uranium together, and Iran, by the way, is one of those 10 nations, all of that uranium together adds up to enough uranium to fuel our nuclear power plants for about 20 years. It's also a non-renewable resource, it turns out. These so-called saviors of the system are calling for further raising the retirement age from the current 67, which is how old those born in 1960 will have to be in order to retire, to 69. So, not to worry, you'll have jobs at Walmart. Maybe you can get a governor. Maybe you can get a government job. Well, don't try it in Frankfort, Kentucky. Governor Ernie Fletcher's administration investigated some applicants for merit jobs to determine their policy loyalty, then acted against Democrats, according to internal records filed in court on Friday. This from the Herald Leader. In one case, an applicant had Democratic bumper stickers, which was noted next to his name on a list of job seekers. In another, Fletcher aides dropped the recommended candidate for a job when they uncovered his donations to the campaigns of Democratic Governor Paul Patton and Ben Chandler, the Democrat who lost to Fletcher in 2003. But the Washington Post points out, Terrence O'Hara, it pays more than ever to be at the top. The median compensation For the 100 highest paid executives in the Washington Post annual survey, 5.25 million, as I mentioned before. Dave B. Wolf, 50, president and chief executive of Coventry Healthcare, Inc. of Bethesda, had the richest compensation package of any Washington area executive in 2004. His salary, bonus, perks, and stock options put his total compensation at $32.3 million. That's just about what Dick Cheney got when he walked away from Halliburton to become vice president. And 21 of these chief executives who are making millions, their companies actually lost money last year. They actually lost money. Of the 100 highest paid executives, by the way, 97 were men. The local companies, that is the Washington, D.C. locals, in the 2004 survey collectively paid their 764 top executives more than $500 million in cash, perks worth $67 million, and $188 million in restricted stock and other long-term incentive payments. Assuming a stock price increase of 5% for all companies over the life of the option grants, the 767 executives will take in an additional $550 million. Just the $40.6 million in salary and bonuses taken home collectively by just the five highest paid executives is twice the budget of the entire Washington, D.C. public library system. Which brings us to Der Spiegel, where I began this rant. Want to become Bush's next ambassador? Asks Georg Muscolo in Der Spiegel. Want to become a U.S. ambassador? It's not as hard as you may think. Just donate a couple of $100,000 to President George W. Bush's campaign coffers and pick your city. The president's new cadre of diplomats tend to be generous campaign donors, including the wealthy Ohio ball bearing manufacturer who is expected to run the new U.S. embassy in Berlin. The Germans, it seems, are a little offended by the fact that the new U.S. ambassador to Germany got the job by being a fundraiser for Bush. In fact, they say, in Der Spiegel, it's possible that David Wilkins, 58, is just a tad too honest for his new job as ambassador of the United States and Canada. How else to explain his admission that he's only visited America's big neighbor to the north once in his life, 34 years ago, on a visit to see Niagara Falls? Wilkins, a deeply religious South Carolina Republican, sees his appointment to the diplomatic corps as, quote, a sign of God, end quote. In truth, writes Der Spiegel, one could probably look to more worldly reasons to explain the appointment. Wilkins is one of the Republican Party's most talented fundraisers. Yep, sure enough, this guy is a Ranger. That means he raised $200,000 for Bush. Der Spiegel notes, in the coming months, Rangers, that's $200,000, Pioneers, starting at $100,000, and Super Rangers, $300,000 and up, will be beginning their new jobs as diplomats all over the world. According to the most recent count, 30 of the Republican Party's biggest donors have been rewarded with posts in sun-drenched island nations like Mauritius and the Bahamas or in prestigious European capitals. And then they go on to point out that in Berlin, William Robert Timken, 66, an Ohio industrialist, is going to assume the post of U.S. ambassador to Germany this fall, a post that has been vacant for 4 months. He's a super ranger. He asked for the job. They note the consulate for cash principle isn't exactly new. Next tonight's in the White House, parties at Bush's Crawford, Texas Ranch, and invitations to state dinners. Diplomatic service is considered the most sought-after form of recognition for the party's big spenders. They say this has been an unwritten rule ever since Richard Nixon was in the White House. In fact, one I remember quite clearly, I used to have the audio clip of it. I don't have it on this computer, but I've played it for long-time listeners have heard it before, of the Kennedy-Nixon debate, where Jack Kennedy says, we've got to be sure to start appointing ambassadors to countries where the ambassadors speak the language, have some sort of diplomatic experience, and have some commitment to diplomacy, not just giving, you know, wealthy campaign donors these jobs as political plums. And Richard Nixon in the debate did not respond to that point that Kennedy made. Kennedy won. He did not appoint any fundraisers to ambassadorships. But, you know, when Nixon's time came in 72, bang, off to the races. a Pew Global Attitude Study points out that the image abroad of the United States is extremely poor, quote, extremely poor, end quote. This is not going to help, says Der Spiegel. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, they say, is banking on her diplomats to repair the country's damaged reputation and to once again convince foreigners, especially skeptical Europeans, of the benefits of U.S. foreign policy. One U.S. diplomat even expressed hopes that one day the U.S. ambassador to Germany could go on German talk shows without having to rely on an interpreter. However, the U.S. ambassador, Mr. Coates, in Berlin until February this year, was only able to manage a few fragments of German after 3.5 years in office. They are outraged about this in Europe. Hardly any of Bush's new additions to the diplomatic ranks is especially gifted, they say, when it comes to foreign languages. Instead, America's new crop of diplomats bound for the old continent reads like a who's who of Bush's biggest supporters, financial and otherwise. Ronald Spigoli, a pioneer and an investment advisor from California, is going to Rome. Craig Stapleton, a ranger married to one of the president's cousins, will be moving to Paris. Great Britain, accustomed to such hobby ambassadors like no other country in Europe, will be trading in horse breeder William Farish for car dealer Robert Tuttle. And on it goes. Bush's future man in Berlin is an especially well-deserving patron, a man who already played an important role in bankrolling Bush Sr.'s election campaigns. Republican presidents like to use his factory in Canton, Ohio, as a backdrop when promising tax cuts or conjuring up America's economic might in election campaigns. Current president was there just last October when Ohio was considered a swing state. At the Republican convention in New York, Timken was one of the delegates casting his ballot for a second Bush term. Worldwide, his company, which makes ball bearings, has sales in the range of $4.5 billion. They also, by the way, make parts for combat helicopters and combat jets. In fact, he's been awarded 60% of the Pentagon's no-bid contracts for these types of parts ever since Bush Jr. first came into office. Oh, there you go, Bush Jr. In Der Spiegel, the European press referring to George W. Bush as Bush Jr. Democrats revile Timken, who holds degrees in economics and history from top U.S. universities, Harvard and Stanford, as a typical example of Bush capitalism. This otherwise known as crony capitalism. So I can tell you that the Germans are furious. They are not happy. Oh, who is now? I mean, George Bush has so devastated the reputation of the United States. The last country in the last 100 years to invade another country for no purpose except to expand its own political power was Germany invading Poland. 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. It's just time to pay the price. Not
listening to advice. Deciding in your youth. And welcome back, my friends. Speaking of the rich getting rich and the poor getting poorer, all of us are going to get a lot poorer if this energy bill that just passed the Senate and has already passed the House, after reconciliation and conference committee, is put into law. The Public Utility Holding Company Act, PUHCA, is an old law. I believe it dates back to the Great Depression. I may be wrong on that. I'll have to get a little more detail on it. But I know the Public Utility Holding Company Act is a law that prevents big utilities, from one state to another, from merging with each other. And, or at least regulates them, controls them. It gives us, gives we the people, some control over our public utilities. It's very straightforward. And both the House version and the Senate version of Bush's energy bill, both of them, will repeal the Public Utility Holding Company Act. This is just going to open the absolute floodgate door to more Enron-type behaviors. Not to mention the fact that there's, you know, what, $14 billion worth of pork in there, you know, of just out-and-out freebies for industry. I mean, it's really, really quite remarkable. So I just wanted to point that out to you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Mike in Eureka, California on the line. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hello. I having to do with everything you're saying, I think that the trickle-down is taking place again in that I'm doing a battle right now with SBC, the phone company, and it, where I don't get good service from them. And I'm not just talking about technical service, but that I have tremendous problems with any type of cooperation. They don't want to speak even politely. They, as you yeah. well know, the phone companies used to treat you as a customer, and they used to treat you well. So my question, I guess, so I'm gonna abbreviate this, so I'll just get it right down to the form of, the, of a question. Why, by all of this, other than the fact that I think an example has been set by Enron, you know, for one, where you, there can be bullies in at every link, and so why at this point have we gotten down to the point where even the phone companies can be bullies to us? Our only little,
because we have bullies in charge. We have people. We have ideologues in charge who believe. Really believe in the pseudo-Darwinian notion, and this, by the way, was not a notion that Darwin actually promulgated, that the strong will eat the weak. In fact, Darwin pointed out that you have to have both the strong and the weak. You have to have, you know, you have to have balance. Now, within a species, of course, ultimately over time, Dawkins is right about the selfish gene and all that, but nonetheless, you have ideologues who are saying that if somebody is rich and powerful, that there is, first of all, you have the neo-Calvinists who are saying that means that there's a dispensation from God. That means that they have some special blessing, some special goodness. And that's implicit in a lot of their statements. But beyond that, they simply say, hey, you know, power is because power has. Power has power.
Tom, I understand all that. How, though, how does it filter down to the customer representative?
Oh, because culture,
the phone company
culture always filters down. In every corporation, the corporate culture, you talk to somebody working on the front lines, and you know the way that they're treated by their supervisors, who are treated by their supervisors, all the way up to the CEO.
No, I've challenged them that.
Corporate culture does filter down. I've seen that. I've worked as a consultant with a number of large corporations and government agencies as well, and I'll tell you, corporate culture filters down. Period.
Anyone, oh, I know that.
You know,
okay,
for better or for worse. I mean, the better examples are like JetBlue and Southwest Airlines, and the worse examples are, of course,
exactly.
What you're talking about.
Good. So what are we going to do?
Well, what we're going to do is we're going to take back the United States House of Representatives and the Senate in 2006, and we're going to start changing the laws to say, you know, this kind of behavior that doesn't serve the public good. It, you know, it's fine to make money, fine to have a corporation, but when you're behaving in a way that actually harms people, we're not going to let you do that anymore. And when corporations get so large that they threaten democracy itself, we're not going to allow that either. We're going to go back to Jimmy Carter's idea of busting up the big monopolies.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Yes, although what we're seeing right now in the Republican-led Senate and House of Representatives is kind of moving us in the opposite direction. PUCA, I mentioned earlier, the public utility holding company Public Utility Holding Company Act was passed in 1935. And the reason they passed it was because at the time that it was passed, There are three companies in the United States control basically about 90% of all energy in the country. And the government said, hey, this is not good. Right? They're taking advantage of the consumers. It may have led to the Great Depression. In fact, as the AFL-CIO notes on their website, the energy industry in the 1920s resembled many aspects of today's, with rampant consolidation creating sprawling multi-state utility holding companies. Officials in a given state were unable to regulate holding companies that owned both regulated utilities and non-regulated subsidiaries in multiple states. So basically, they were able to gouge electricity consumers and defraud investors. I mean, that was the bottom line. Enron, in fact, came about because the Reagan administration and the Bush senior administration and the Clinton administration were willing to allow Ken Lay to have exemptions from PUCA. Very simply, the whole California energy crisis would not have happened if PUCA had not been repealed. By the way, the last time there was a vote to repeal this was on April 24th, 2001. AFL-CIO notes that if PUCA is repealed, and keep in mind, the energy bill that just passed the Senate and the one that had already passed the House, they're now in conference committee where they'll get reconciled, they'll get merged into one bill. This energy bill has at its core the elimination of PUCA, the Public Utility Holding Company Act, eliminating this law that goes back to 1935 that regulated utility companies. What will happen? Three things, according to the AFL-CIO. Number one, if PUCA is repealed, we will see a level of consolidation in the industry mirroring the days leading to the Great Depression and the passage of PUCA. Before PUCA, three companies controlled half of all electricity generated in the U.S. At the time of the Energy Policy Act 1992, the 10 largest investor-owned utilities only controlled a third, 36% of the electricity generated in this country. By 1998, that number had reached 40%, and by 2000, it was 51%. Just look at this trend. You can see where we're going. You eliminate PUCA, it's going to be... This is the same thing that happened when Bill Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act, and all of a sudden, all of our media is basically owned by a handful of companies, 10 companies, with interlocking boards, and news has become infotainment. Well, you're going to see energy become just a new way to gouge you. Number one. Number two, rate hikes in watered stock. Here in Oregon, I can tell you, for example, the Portland General Electric, PGE, which is owned by Enron, big scandal. They've collected millions, perhaps certainly tens of millions, perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars in state and federal taxes from the ratepayers. Okay, on my bill, there's the, you know, okay, you owe so many dollars this month, and here's a few extra dollars of taxes. And everybody pays it, you know, okay, I'll pay the tax. And then Enron has said to the federal government, well, we don't have to pay you the tax because we have losses that we can use to offset those. And so the ratepayers of Oregon have given hundreds of millions of dollars, or at least well over $100 million, as I recall, $1 million to Enron as tax payments that Enron never passed along to the government. They simply stuck in their pocket. And the third outcome of repealing PUCA, says the AFL-CIO, depression. With nothing to protect investors from overinflated utility holding company stock and nothing preventing the types of mergers in the utility industry like those of the 1920s, there's nothing to prevent the economy of 1929 through 1935, the year PUCA was passed. No doubt shareholders will lose millions as the more frequent Excel and AES debacles of even larger scale unfold. At the same time, small businesses and residential utility customers will be captive to skyrocketing utility bills. Coming to a utility near you. This is just absolutely mind-boggling. By the way, I don't want to pass this by without talking about it briefly. The Supreme Court. We did not see a retirement notice yesterday from Mr. Rehnquist, which was expected. It may be he's going to try and hang on for another year, or even another couple of years. It may be that many of these justices are looking at George W. Bush and going, whoa, I don't think it would be prudent to retire now. You'll recall back in late 1999 or early 2000, before Bush was appointed president by the Supreme Court. Sandra Day O'Connor, in an interview with, as I recall, Barbara Walters, there was a television interview, said that she would like to retire, but she didn't want to retire while Bill Clinton was president because he was a Democrat. She wanted to retire under a Republican president so that her successor would be appointed by a Republican president as well. And then Bush comes into office, George Jr., and Sandra Day O'Connor looked around and said, oh, wait a minute, this guy isn't a Republican. He's a right-wing extremist. And I have a feeling that there's a number of members of the Supreme Court who are hanging on for dear life. I mean, this is the longest period of time. I believe it's the second longest period of time in the history of the court. The last one being like in the 1830s or something. The second longest period of time in the Supreme Court without a vacancy on the court in the history of the United States. Why would they hang on so long? Because they are scared to death of what will happen if they retire. And now it turns out that there's a big battle going on. The Wall Street Journal today, a front-page article called, under the split opinions of the subhead, the headline, for a high court nomination, business has its own agenda. Corporate lobby diverges from Christian groups on states' rights issue. And basically what the argument is pointing out is that Justices Thomas and Scalia, who are the model for George W. Bush for future nominees, who are, you know, very anti-abortion and pro-religion, are also pro-states' rights. And pro-states' rights is not something that goes over well with big multinational corporations. They don't like states having rights. They want the federal government to have all the power where they can just, you know, in Washington, D.C., do their lobbying, pay their bribes, campaign contributions, and have it done with. And so here's a long, detailed article by Jeannie Cummings, brilliant article in the Wall Street Journal today, pointing out that the business lobby has a very concerned that the Christians may be pushing something. Well, here, the emerging corporate agenda is different from and at times contradicts that of their religious conservative allies. The Christian right, represented by groups such as the Family Research Council in Washington, had been lobbying the Bush administration to appoint a Supreme Court justice who opposes abortion and gay marriage and favors school prayer and public religious displays. Top business priorities include more protection for intellectual property rights, more flexibility in clean air emission standards, restriction of jury awards, and a lenient interpretation of the Sarbanes-Oxley law that imposes new accountability and disclosure requirements on business. These are very different things. So now business is saying, hey, we've got to get out, we've got to get active. They're going to start lobbying to say, please don't put a religious conservative into the Supreme Court. Religious conservatives, by contrast, tend to embrace the more traditional conservative positions favoring states' rights. So they encourage states and municipalities to stretch or go beyond high court precedents on abortion, prayer in public, or religious displays. Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council and a former Louisiana legislator, says he is well aware that business wants national rules that preempt the sometimes conflicting patchwork of state and local regulation. But, quote, that is inconsistent with the predominant judicial philosophy that the president has nominated, end quote, he says. In fact, the Wall Street Journal says the biggest heroes of social conservatives, Justices Thomas and Scalia, have given jitters to corporate lawyers. Interesting. Very, very interesting. And then on top of that, the Wall Street Journal interactive, an interesting little piece here. The nine men, eight white men, one African-American, who are considered the top candidates for the Supreme Court. Samuel Alito, Jr., in 1991, he dissented in the Planned Parenthood versus Casey case, in which he argued to uphold a Pennsylvania law requiring a married woman to inform her husband before getting an abortion. They like him. He's a member of the Federalist Society. Emilio Garza, another one that they rather like. He's on the Fifth Circuit. He's on record as saying Roe v. Wade lacks a constitutional basis and states should have the right to limit abortion. Alberto Gonzalez, he's the guy who wrote the memo saying the Geneva Conventions are quaint. Now, the anti-abortion people are a little concerned about Gonzalez. He is Catholic, but they're not really sure about his position on abortion. They think he might be too much of a moderate. J. Michael Luttig, he's on record as being against abortion. Also back to the state of Virginia's law to require parental notification on teen abortions. He's a big lover of the death penalty. His father was murdered in a carjacking in 1994, and ever since then he's been on a crusade. Put them guys to death. Mitchell McConnell, another person who is a good chance he'll be nominated by the Bush administration. Known at the Wall Street Journal, says, known as a brilliant conservative scholar of constitutional law, he has openly supported overturning Roe v. Wade or limiting its reach. Another one, Ted Olson. Ted Olson, the hack lawyer who was spearheading much of the, or orchestrating much of the impeach Clinton campaign. His wife Barbara died in one of the hijacked planes that crashed into the Pentagon. He has worked to overturn or limit affirmative action. Doesn't mention. I believe he also was one of the ones who argued Bush v. Gore. I may be wrong on that, but I believe he argued before the Supreme Court on behalf of the administration. In fact, I'm pretty sure he also argued before the Supreme Court on the, in fact, I know it, on the case of their being able to keep Jose Padilla and others, in custody without them seeing without him having access to a lawyer. This is a guy who hates the Bill of Rights. John G. Roberts, Jr., he is associated with a push by the Reagan and first Bush administrations to overturn or limit Roe v. Wade. Larry Thompson, conservatives cite him as an attractive choice to become the second black justice on the high court. His primary thing, he hates affirmative action. Known for his antipathy to affirmative action, he's considered more moderate than his longtime friend Clarence Thomas. And finally, J. Harvey Wilkerson III, he's the guy who ruled that citizens and aliens held as enemy combatants have no rights. So, you know, what do you want? What are you going to get? It's going to be either, you know, a loss, total loss of rights for everybody, or a loss of rights for women, one or the other. Speaking of women, Joy in Santa Cruz, California on the line. Hey, Joy, what's up?
Oh, boy, it sounds like no matter which one we get, we're in trouble.
That's the roster. That's from today's Wall Street Journal, the 9 leading candidates.
Wow. Oh, wow. Well, we have to take back the House.
Yeah.
Well, there is, too. Speaking of which, I don't know, I guess you mentioned it earlier, but John Conyers and all of them are going to be down on the representative floor after business hours.
Yes.
Discussing the Downing Street memo to get it on the record.
Yeah, and in fact, I believe that C-SPAN is going to cover that.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, okay. So that's certainly worth checking out.
Oh, yeah. I love watching him talk anyway. He's great. Yeah.
And also contact your member of Congress. Your
right.
And if you don't know who your congressman or congresswoman is, you call this toll-free number I'm going to give you in just a second, and just give them your zip code, and they'll connect you to your member of Congress. Everybody has two senators and one representative, one member of the House of Representatives. And call your member of the House of Representatives and tell them to get down there and support John Conyers, or simply to be there, and even if they disagree with him, be there and listen to him, even argue with him, but just to be there.
Absolutely.
And listen to the testimony. And you can call them by calling 1-877, toll-free, 877-SOB-USOB. SOB, the letter U, SOB. It's the old Senate office building phone number. It rings right into the switchboard at Capitol Hill.
That's exactly the other thing I was going to say. Do that. But I also wanted to get your hit on what – can you do a prediction and tell us what you think Bush is going to say tonight? You think he's going to attack the liberals?
If he has an opportunity. Yeah, I think so. I think that Karl Rove was floating a trial balloon to see how it went. Frankly, I doubt he'll say exactly what Rove said. But I
Better
think
not.
That, number one, he's going to invoke 9/11, as he always does, even though Iraq has nothing to do with 9/11. It's a distraction from it. Number two, he's going to claim that those Iraqis who are trying to throw the occupiers, us, out of their country are actually terrorists, and it's a war against terrorism, and we're fighting them there, so we won't have to fight them here, which is nonsense.
And,
yeah. And you know, these are going to be the core, I'm assuming, the core assumptions of what he's going to talk about tonight. And he's going to do everything he can to divert us, you know, get our attention away from the disastrous policy that he's lied us into.
Yeah.
And
he's so predictable.
Well, the interesting thing is there are now news reports out that suggesting that Tony Blair is about to pull the British troops out of Iraq.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And, that's a new one.
Yeah. And, I give some credibility to these. Blair came over here asking George Bush for some help, and Bush essentially slapped him down and said, no, we're not going to help out. Yes, I committed $15 billion to AIDS in, or $5 billion to AIDS in Africa, but it's not coming forward. We're not going to make the money. And Blair went back, and I think Blair is really, really angry, and I think he's taking so much heat, so much political heat over this. I think he's willing to walk away from it. Joy, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. This is the Tom Hartman radio program, 10 minutes before the hour. Talk radio for the rest of us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Whatever happened to the values of humanity? Whatever happened to the fairness and equality? Instead of spreading love, we're spreading animosity. Lack of understanding leading us away from unity.
And we'll see more of it tonight as George Bush gets up there and continues his assault on the common sense and goodwill of the American people with comments like...
Facing clear evidence of peril. We cannot wait for the final proof. The smoking gun. It could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
Yeah. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Amy in San Diego, California on the line. Hey, Amy, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, thank you. I wanted to respond to one of your callers a couple minutes ago. He wanted to know, what can we do?
Mm-hmm.
Well, everyone must get active. They must get involved.
Yes.
And I feel the most important reform, the reform that allows other reforms to happen, is publicly funded campaigns. Everyone listening to the radio, they can go to www.publiccampaign, and public and campaign same, share the same C in the middle, .org, and you can find your state and find your local chapter. And there wasn't a local chapter in San Diego, so I started one.
Great. Good on you.
And it's easy to do, and everyone must do something. We can't all sit back and say, you know, when is someone going to do something? We need to do something.
Absolutely. I agree. And this is why I encourage people to participate in not just the Democratic Party, but also the Green
yes.
Party, progressive movements. And, you know, number one, we absolutely have to take back the Democratic Party.
We
or for those
to.
Who are Republicans, I gave a speech on Saturday at Olivet College, Olivet, Michigan, and an elderly couple came up to me afterwards. They looked like they were probably in their mid to late 70s.
Uh-huh.
And the woman was speaking to me, and she said, my husband and I have been Republicans for 50 years. And we are still Republicans. And she said, I want you to know that we have gone down and we have talked with people, the local Republican Party, and they're good people, and they really care about this country,
yes.
and they are concerned. She said, and we are concerned, and this is, she's a Republican. She said, and we are concerned about the crazies who have taken over our party.
Absolutely. That is so true. And this, the public campaign thing is bipartisan or nonpartisan. And I plan on speaking at my, I'm a, you know, a hard blue Democrat, but I'm going to the Republicans, because like you said, we can't do anything like this alone. We must, it must be broad-based.
No, the Republicans have to take back
they
their party
to.
Too. We,
yes.
we need to restore
yes.
integrity to both parties.
Absolutely.
And get the corporations out of them. And you're right, Amy, that having publicly funded elections is going to be a huge step in the right direction.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you very
Bye.
Much. Hey, Amy.
Yes.
You're still there. What was
yes.
the URL again, real quick?
What was my what?
The URL, the website.
Oh, I'm sorry. Public, it's www.publiccampaign.org. And
Great.
Public and campaign share the same C. There's not
Great.
Two C's.
Good on
Thank
you.
You.
Thank you, Amy. Thanks a lot. Publiccampaign.org. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Thanks for being with us today. We'll see you again tomorrow. Same time, same place. Right back here in the real free speech zone. No barbed wire, no passes from the RNC required. We'll let you in. You can speak. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.